So I'm Rob Bryan. I'm the Green Councillor for St George West Ward. I'm currently the whip for the Green Group, although we don't use a whip. I am the person who organises the group. And I've previously sat on the Transport Connectivity Policy Committee for 2 years. And the East Bristol neighbourhood is in my ward, part of
Well,
it.
some people may have come across you in a previous life as Rob Telford. What? How come the name changed?
I got married and then we decided to change our name. And as has been publicised before, there was yeah, there was a slight feeling that we might want to go with a name that's higher up the alphabet, which is funny to a lot of people, but also they see it as a like a scathing indictment of the political class. When actually, it's, we like the name and it happens to be near the top of the alphabet. Ironically, when I actually stood for election, there were two people above me on the ballot paper. So much for that idea. I was the councillor for Ashley Ward between 2013 and 2016 as well.
You certainly were. Look, can I ask, was it pressure from your partner? Was this like arm twisting?
No, we wanted to change our name because we both didn't want our own surname because we didn't want to take each other's surname. She didn't want mine, I didn't want hers, so we came up with a new name. It was very mutual, yeah.
Okay, well, anyway, look, to this East Bristol Liverpool neighbourhood. Some of the people I've been speaking to around there just see this as a whole bunch of roadblocks appearing in their streets, which means they can't get around. And also these tolls where various people are being tricked into going through where there's no actual no entry sign and having to pay, rather a lot of money to Bristol City Council. They see it as just a system of tolls.
So, like, who have you spoken to? I mean, that's a key question for me
Well,
because depending on who you
there's
talk to, it's, it
yeah.
depends on what your perspective is. And I think that's one perspective that's been prevalent in a discussion, and there are
Yeah, but
others as
how would
well.
you answer those points?
Well, they're not roadblocks. That's not the right definition. They're called modal filters. And the reason that's important is because, of course, buses, bikes, scooters, people using the, hire e-scooters. Are all allowed through them. And so they're open to those people. So they're not blocks at all. So that's wrong. that's just wrong, plain wrong. So that's one thing I'd respond to. Secondly, on what you're calling tolls, but are actually bus gates, they're again modal, a form of modal filter whereby you prioritize buses over other forms of transport. And we have to do these things because we have a climate emergency, we have an air pollution crisis, we have people living more and more sedentary lifestyles. Particularly young people who we need to give options to have active travel, to be able to access the city using public transport. That's the way that the direction of travel will have to go if we're going to adapt, partly adapt climate change, but also lessen it, and not go over our carrying capacity of the planet.
Well, obviously, fire engines and buses can't go through planters when they're in the middle of the road, can they, Rob?
No, but then we've changed that, Tony. We've changed the actual way that people get into the scheme area in certain key ways. At Ducie Road, that where there's planters currently, we've already changed that so it's ANPR, so people can access it, so the emergency vehicles can access it. We've changed it at my end of the scheme, which is the Avenue, and that will also have ANPR, so people will be able to get in emergency vehicles and things like that. We are the development of the permanent scheme has been completely in line with the way that the emergency services have told us they need the scheme to operate, and largely their public statements. Now you can go that the anecdote of talking to someone with a specific view who works for the ambulance service, that's fine, but the actual lines that they've been giving us are it's we've been able to get operationally to everywhere we need to get to. So it's just not, it's not the factor that people make out it to be.
Well, I think many people wouldn't mind so much if the buses and the public transport were cheap and efficient. I mean, we've got this rather bizarre situation where people have got a real-time information about a bus coming, etc. They're waiting at the bus stop, a little sign flashes, the bus goes, it's now 1 minute, now zero, and no buses appeared, the so-called phantom buses. And also the fares. But many people are pointing out a very, really, very expensive. So, okay. So if you go cycle back about 50 years or so, when these buses were Much cheaper, they were provided at cost by the city council. Now they've been privatised. And so, are you happy with the public transport provision that's as an alternative to people using their car in the city?
Well, if you look at what's actually happened in this scheme, we have boosted public transport. We've got the number 5, number 16, both go through the EBL area. They've increased their patronage by 100 plus percent. So all the buses go down Church Road, which run through the EBLN, through the boundary roads of the EBLN. They've seen a 5% increase in ridership. So it has actually improved public transport scheme. So we set up this dichotomy between, oh, well, you should do public transport first before you do all this stuff. It's actually both. And we have done both. And the fact is that when you've got public transport that isn't reliable, what is the number one factor on that? It's the amount of traffic. It's the amount of general traffic, which is private cars largely. Okay, yeah, there's a lot of people who do need cars for because they might be disabled or because they might be, for their work. They might actually need it for their work. But there's a hell of a lot of people who don't. And that's the point of this scheme is to encourage people not to use them. On the wider point about, privatized bus services, yeah, I'm fully in favor of public transport, public ownership of our bus services and having a municipal bus company and taking power away from the bus companies so that we can run them for the public good. The levers for that are at the West of England Combined Authority level. Is we've been calling for a long time for franchising as a first step in terms of the legal framework we can do. Until we get to the point we can either do franchising or even go even further and have proper public ownership of buses, we will continue to see communities unserved. And the council has got some scope to do like subsidised bus services, and we've done some good work on that. Part of that was what brought the 16 about, is that we got this first connection that we've ever had. Well, in my memory anyway, between East Bristol and Temple Meads. I mean, it's ridiculous that for all that length of time, we had no bus connection from large swathes of East Bristol to the main train station. And now we have it, or at least we have a service that goes pretty close. We just want to like figure out more ways to get more subsidized services. And we'll continue to negotiate with First about their fares, but they are, as we know, a private operation, and they can charge what they like, basically. It's not really within our gift to we'll continue to push for like caps and keeping those in place. But unless the UK government and our combined authority takes action on these things, we will consistently have a less than reliable service that doesn't cover enough areas.
Yeah, so I mean, if you're elderly, it's a wet day, whatever. In a cold, blowing a gale in the winter, it's not really on, is it, for to expect elderly people to get a scooter or bike into town?
Well, I mean, it depends, doesn't it? It depends on the elderly person. I mean, you look at some other countries, maybe in that example you give, no, yes, n no. But there are very many older people who are taking up cycling, partly because of the now prevalence of e-bikes. That gives a bit of a boost. It gives you a bit of a helping hand, fair enough. And if you look at like Netherlands, there's loads and loads of people who are over 60, 70, even 80 who are still cycling. So, yeah, maybe for specific people who can't.
People would point out in Holland, almost all the transport, public transport, is all state run and is actually something like a third of the cost of here. So there's a big encouragement. Now, I mean, on terms, in terms, East Bristol is quite a poor area. How much money have you made from the bus gates, people going through these by accident?
I haven't got a figure on that, so I'm not going to quote anything. But the question of poverty and relative income is clearly part of the scheme design. Now, this wasn't designed by I'm a Green Party. Obviously, I'm a Green Party person. I'm a Green Party councillor. This was designed by the last Labour administration. And one aspect of it that I would think is a good thing is that they looked at three different areas that varied in terms of their income. So you've got the Barton Hill area and sort of the Lawrence Hill area that's perhaps more deprived. Although it should be pointed out that they often have and they do have some of the lowest car ownership in the city. So actually they're much more dependent on other forms of transport. So you've got Barton Hill, and then you've got Redfield, and then you've got St George. And you would say that's a sliding scale of income. The further you get up in St George, so my area, the wealthier people become. So it's not being done just to one community. And I think if we dived at it just to like a Clifton, or just to a Barton Hill, there would be a level of it'd be problematic. And I think by doing it over a larger scheme area, that's the thing that presents the most difficulty, the largeness of the area, arguably, like the actual scale of it is the thing that a lot of people find difficult. that I think you actually you cover off this idea that this is kind of penalizing poor people or being advantageous for rich people. If you do it over the whole area, then everyone can see that this is an equitable thing that's really about the
So
transport
when are you going to
intervention.
do this in Clifton? Are you biting your fingernails about that one?
No, I don't think we're practicing in Clifton at the moment. But I'm certainly, from my perspective, the whole of Bristol, or at least all of the areas which will be covered by our transport movement plan, which is basically saying these are the roads we want the traffic to be on for it to circulate around the city. And then the other roads, we don't really want it to be on. We want it to be accessed. Of course, people need to be able to access their homes by car, but we don't want through traffic on these roads. Certainly, I think most areas of Bristol could benefit from something like this. And I think that is where we need to go in terms of getting our active travel up, in terms of getting our bus routes more connected, in terms of delivering health outcomes that benefit people rather than just waiting around for something to happen,
Well, I mean, it
which
does
is the
sound to
alternative.
me a little bit like with the travellers up on the Downs. It's a sort of whack-a-mole problem. It's going to move somewhere else if you try and deal with it in this sort of manner.
But
And
that
if you go
that's
around the clean
exactly.
air zone, hang on, if you go around the clean air zone, say, for example, on Ashley Road, anywhere that's a road that is circumnavigating round your clean air zone is getting incredibly busy. And in fact, what you've got is, is pollution. Hotspots all around there as people drive two or three times further than they would have done to get round the clean air zone.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, again, was a decision to go for a smaller zone. There's an option to go for a larger zone by the Labour administration that we previously had, and he didn't go for that. He didn't go for the more radical option, which I think they should have done.
Well,
That
look,
was a bit
hang
of my.
on, because most places would, in most cities and London, for example, what they did is they looked. For example, with London initially, the South Circular Road. Here's a big road, a designed to be a big road, and the North Circular to make it easy for people to go around and circumnavigate it without causing too much trouble. Well, what's happening in Bristol is much smaller roads have been now turned into a sort of inner circle around the city.
Well, I'd be arranged in smaller. Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I'm not disagreeing with your analysis in the sense that people will try to not go into the clean air zone.
I'm saying it's not really been thought through, the idea that people are going to have to get round this zone, and that they're having to go through much smaller roads than in somewhere like London to do so. It seems it was almost like a back of a fag packet map
Are
that was
we?
designed.
Are we talking about the clean air zone, or are we talking about EBLN?
Yeah, we're
Because
talking about the clean air zone now.
okay, I'm not gonna defend a scheme that I didn't put in or didn't have any say in. I think it should have been larger. On the whack-a-mole question, I think you're right. Yeah, whatever size it could be, you would get people trying to avoid it, whatever size it is, right? For me, that is just an argument for proper road pricing, like the actual costs and the externalities of private car use in cities are immense, and we need to contend with that. And the way to contend with that is to have some kind of equitable system whereby it does cost money to use the roads. Now, that is, for most people, political, it's anathema to them. They don't want to even consider that, and it hasn't been considered largely. But we will see over the coming years more and more people realize that one of the biggest emission sectors is transport, and we have to bring the emissions down. It's a large sector. It's pretty unshifting over the last 20, 25, 30 years. So, like, we can talk around the houses about, oh, well, you're just knocking it on some other area. Actually, we deal with it across the whole
No, well,
city.
I totally agree with you. Only thing is, I don't know how old you are, but I'm 64 now, and when I was a youngster, there were hardly any cars anywhere. Everyone used to walk to the bus stop. There was a bus every 5 or 6 minutes, and then if you needed to go a bit further, there was a train which would cost
Yeah.
you whatever, 30 pence to get into the middle of the city, and hardly
Yeah.
anyone used cars.
I mean, yeah, even in living memory, I used to live in Manchester, and we used to get the bus down Oxford Road, and it was £1, but they were all competing with each other. So weirdly, that was maybe an argument for
But
privatisation,
surely
not.
this is the solution, isn't it? Decent, cheap public transport. Well, people won't bother with cars.
Yeah, but I mean, how do you get that to happen if in a privatised system? I mean, the example I just gave in Manchester, there were about three or four competing bus operators. What we found in Bristol is we've got this one, but one very dominant operator, obviously First Bus, and they don't really have an incentive to lower the prices. And without any mark, without any sort of state regulation mechanism, I mean, but the bus cap, the bus fare cap, is good, but it doesn't go far enough, and it got weakened. You know, they started off, I think, £2. Now it's £3, isn't it? So, I agree wholly that
Well, so
that is the thing. But it.
what would you say to people that I've spoken to in East Bristol who say it seems to me as if because they can't actually do anything much about the buses, that Bristol City Council have decided to just draft in Sastrans to do exactly what they want, and the only real priority now are the cyclists and the scooter riders.
Well, I mean, I don't know the details about how many contracts Sustrans currently have for the council, but yeah, I couldn't quote anything on that. It seems to me that there are people who believe that, yeah, the council is not on their side, and they're probably not going to be convinced by anything I say. They're probably not going to be convinced if they don't think this kind of scheme is necessary. It's quite hard to convince people, and that's the other thing I'd say about a scheme like the EBLN or any kind of change in the way that we do transport. Is it is difficult at the beginning because it is no one likes change, or at least a lot of people don't really like change. They want things to stay as they are, and they're worried and concerned, and it's for the good reasons in many cases.
Well, I think
But
people would
when
like
you get to
change
the point of
if it meant that there were less cars around and that there was a cheap alternative. I think they wouldn't mind change.
But for sure, but also look at actually what does drive change. So Luxembourg, I think, has made its entire, it's a tiny country, obviously, but it's made its entire country free public transport, partly because it's wealthy, so it can do that and it not have a massive impact on their public finances, but also because it's a totemic thing. Does that actually change the amount of people using public transport? No, because that isn't the only factor. Price is a factor, but it's not the only factor.
No, but I mean, it's an enormous. I remember when Ken Livingstone tried to do that in the 1980s in London. Just the first year he did it, there was something like 4,000 less serious accidents on the roads.
Sure, and I don't want to. We're getting into a London off because some people like us talking about London and Bristol, and some people don't like us talking about London and Bristol. I think you're right. I think, but the context for London was obviously they've got the underground system. They've got an effective bus network that is not quite public again, but it has, you know,
Well, we never
TfL.
had that in South London, I can tell you. We know not many undergrounds there.
Right, you're right, true, yeah. So, but I think we could go around the houses on this. I want cheap, potentially free public transport, but I'm also aware that that isn't the panacea, and that if we think of it as being the thing that will shift everything, we're in for a rude awakening if we ever do bring it in, because it is more about restraint, and it is more about, and that's the sad, that is the difficult thing for people to contend with. It's about people being encouraged to drive less and making it more inconvenient to drive, and for some people that is anathema. They don't agree with that as a perspective because they like driving their car, and in some ways, you know, many of us do. Like, we like the experience of being in a car. It is, at the moment, for many journeys, more convenient, and when there is this inconvenience that we're finding through this scheme. For some people, we are finding that we aren't going to get everyone to switch. But
No.
for that, there have been people who've switched because they've
Yeah,
gone, this is
but
stupid.
look,
I'm sitting in traffic. Why would I sit in traffic when I can get on a bike if I'm able to do that, or find a bus route that works, or use a scooter, or walk potentially.
yeah. Anyway, look, what do you make finally of this accusation about this being a 15-minute cities World Economic Forum style, where basically the council is only doing this because it's getting help from central government and other sources to do it.
Well, it is doing it because we're getting into sources of funding from central government, but it's not a World Economic Forum thing. I mean, 15-minute cities is basically what you were describing earlier. It's what we used to have before cars became dominant over cities. It's the idea that you can get anywhere within a city by walking or cycling in 15 minutes, and all of the services that you need are in that length. It's not saying you can't leave, which is kind of the rhetoric we sometimes say. It's like almost like a open air prison or something. It's saying that you should have those services. It's saying, do you want a good quality of life? Do you want to be able to get a doctor nearby, a dentist nearby, a NHS dentist nearby, a corner shop nearby, a hairdresser, all the things that we might think of as necessary high street services should be within
Yeah,
that
but
radius.
shops and pubs are closing, Rob, aren't they? They're being turned over to housing because it's more profitable.
Yeah, no, it's a massive problem, and I think in some cases where it's not viable, you have to go down that route. But it's really depressing that there's not more government action to prevent it. I mean, one of the key planning applications, I was sat on a planning committee up until May, and one of the key applications that we refused was to change the Giant Gorham in Lawrence Weston, no, yeah, Lawrence Weston, into housing. It didn't need to be. It's the only community pub in that entire area of the city, and yet our officers are recommending to approve that. We're like, well, no, we need to keep whatever state this pub is. It needs to remain at the heart of the community. We have an incredibly profit-driven housing system. It's not driven by the government intervention in the way it should be. It should be about council housing. It should be about large-scale council housing. Modern standards, ecologically sound, solar PV, heat pumps, all of these things have to be by central government
Yeah,
intervention and
but
a
the planning
program.
system is eating into these shared community resources like the pubs, like the shops. So you're living in a fantasy world.
What do you mean it's eating into them?
It's
Hello?
taking away these facilities because they're being closed and they're being turned into housing all over the city. I mean, what you're saying, it sounds great, but it's not happening in the real world.
No, I know, I think, what can you do? Basically, you have to try and lobby central government. I mean, we've got potentially a new prime minister next week, who has an awful lot of stuff on the to-do list, but could be one avenue is that you would say, well, why aren't you? If you believe in regional devolution, if you believe that councils should have more ability to build new council housing, to keep and retain public resources and public council housing, as well as private sector housing, for people to live in, rather than converting it into all these other things. That's what we need to do. The opposite is true as well. If we have high streets that have boarded up shops, we have to find a way to revitalise them. That is essentially what the central government has to direct. It can't just be done by local authorities, but the way that our state is run, it's run as a centralised state. We're one of the most centralized states in the entirety of the world. So that's what we need to change.
Okay, Rob Bry, thanks very much for joining us.
No worries, thanks.